Welcome to the Viscast. I'm your host, Josh Viss. This is the inaugural episode of the Viscast, and so I wanted to take a minute to talk a little bit about what I hope this podcast will be about and what it will accomplish. Mainly, I wanted to give people an opportunity to engage with my work and my ideas, and that will include often interviews with people I work with in relation to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and in relation to the Bible. Those are the two big things I do in my work. I think about and read about and talk about the conflict in Israel and Palestine and the Bible. I imagine there'll be times when I venture into other subject areas based on people I know and people I meet who are really interesting and with whom I think I can have really interesting conversations, but most of the time it will focus on the conflict and the Bible. For my first episode, I have a really, really awesome guest. His name is Gerard Horton of Military Court Watch, and he talks about, in this episode, his work, and his work focuses on the detention of Palestinian children in the Israeli military courts. I remember vividly the first time I heard Gerard speak about this issue. It was riveting, honestly, is the best word I can think of for it. He tells the story of what detention looks like and why Israel does it the way it does it, just in a really, really intriguing and engaging fashion. So I remember I learned so much from listening to him, and I've listened to him give his talk many, many times, and I'm always learning. So I think there's a lot in here for beginners or for people who've even heard about the military courts or even people who've been on trips and have heard Gerard give this talk. It's worth listening to again. Just a couple of things about his talk that I want to clarify. One is, since 1967, Israel has occupied the West Bank and has put the Palestinians in the West Bank under martial law and utilizing military courts since that time. Second thing is, since 1967, Israeli citizens have been building communities inside the West Bank. The military courts and martial law are legal under international law. The placing of your citizens in occupied territory is illegal. There are now 400,000 Israelis living in the West Bank. We call them settlers, and we call the communities they live in settlements. So you will hear us refer to those, settlements and settlers. And he will talk about them because they're a key aspect of the occupation, and their existence is a key reason for the detention of Palestinian children in the West Bank. So, without further ado, I introduce to you Gerard Horton of Military Court Watch. Okay, Gerard, thanks so much for joining me and doing this.
My pleasure.
Yeah, and we're going to just jump right in, and I'm going to ask you to begin with talking about the recent findings about the military courts and what they revealed to you about how they function.
Yeah, so the organization I work with, Military Court Watch, one thing we do is we collect a lot of testimonial evidence. So last year we collected 127 testimonies from children arrested and detained by the Israeli military in the West Bank. Mm-hmm. And there was one striking feature from that body of evidence, and that was where the children were arrested from. So out of 127 cases, 125 children lived and were arrested within 1.02 kilometers from an Israeli settlement. And I think when you've been here for a while and you've looked at the evidence, you realize that is not coincidental.
Right.
There is a clear link between the detention of children by the military in the West Bank and the settlement project.
Sure. And what then would you say is the purpose of detaining children who live near settlements? What does that accomplish for the Israeli military in the West Bank?
So I think a useful way to look at the situation is to put yourself in the shoes of an Israeli military commander. Mm-hmm. And the politicians, in their wisdom, in about September 1967, allowed Israeli citizens to move into the West Bank and live in settlements in violation of international law. Fast forward 50 years, there's now something like 400,000 Israeli civilians living in the West Bank, not including an additional 200,000 living in East Jerusalem. And then the job of protecting those 400,000 civilians living in the West Bank, it was given to the military, and they have to essentially guarantee their protection whilst living amongst 2.9 million Palestinians. I think if you stop and think about that, that is a very difficult job that any military could ever be given. And I think one example we frequently give by way of analogy, imagine if the US government decided to do something similar in Afghanistan and, let's say, moved 400,000 Nebraskans to Kandahar province and told them to build towns and villages, shopping malls, and what have you. Apart from being illegal under international law, I think it's safe to say there'll be a bloodbath in the first day if you try to do that in Kandahar province.
Yeah.
Yet essentially, that's what's been going on in the West Bank for the last 50 years. What I think is really truly remarkable, and it's a testament to the ability of the Israeli military, is the casualty rates among settlers. So, for example, according to the U.S. State Department, every year the U.S. State Department publishes an annual report on human rights. They look at the situation in every country around the world. According to the U.S. State Department, in 2012, not a single settler was killed in the West Bank. Now, that just strikes me as an extraordinary military achievement. There's an Israeli organization called B'Tselem, and they collect a lot of statistics. According to this Israeli organization, the fatality rate among settlers, on average in the past 8 years, is 5.8 settlers have been killed in occupied territory each year for the last 8 years. Now, not to trivialize those deaths when they occur, it is a remarkable achievement. More people die on the roads than in living in settlements in the occupied territory. And the question I think that raises, certainly in my mind, is what are some of the strategies employed by the military in order to make that work? And what is the connection between those strategies and the military courts? And that statistic I gave after the analysis of our evidence of 1.02 kilometers is the distance between where you live and where you're arrested, or the nearest settlement, I should say. And basically, when if you look at the evidence, a lot of evidence over the years, I've been here 10 years, you begin and you talk to former Israeli soldiers, etc. You begin to build up a picture of what that strategy is. And again, I think to understand that, you have to put yourself in the shoes of a soldier. You've been, like I said, you've been given the job by the politicians to guarantee the protection of those settlers. How are you going to do it? So imagine you're an Israeli military commander in the West Bank, and you're in charge of protecting, say, one settlement. Maybe it's a small settlement. Maybe there's no more than 600 settlers living there. And it's surrounded by a number of Palestinian villages, and there's an extensive road network connecting all of that together. And so the settlers are driving every day to and from work and childcare, etc., on these roads, which in most cases are shared by everyone. The Israeli military uses these roads. The settlers use these roads, and the Palestinians use these roads. How do you ensure protection in a situation like that? Not easy. So imagine you're that commander, and someone from the settlement telephones you one morning, and they say they've seen a group of Palestinians on the side of the road throwing stones at settler vehicles. What is your response going to be? You can't trivialize throwing stones. You have to look at each individual case to assess how serious it is. But common sense tells you if you're throwing stones at a road upon which vehicles are traveling at high speed, you know, you can cause a lot of damage. The point being whether you cause damage or you don't cause damage, you have an act of resistance. And the question is, how will you respond to that? The problem you face is this, that if you decide as a soldier to send 4 jeeps to the location in the road to investigate, in all probability, when the jeeps get there, the individuals who were throwing stones will have run off. Few people are going to be silly enough to throw stones at Israelis in the West Bank and wait for the Israeli military to show up. So you're not going to identify anyone in many cases. So that poses a dilemma for you. Who are you going to punish? Who are you going to prosecute in the military courts when you know it's Palestinians, but you can't positively identify exactly who? If you decide to do nothing and hope that maybe you'll have better luck tomorrow catching someone, that's not a viable option in occupied territory. If people get a sense that they can resist you and they can get away with it, you will get more resistance. And you will not be able to maintain those casualty rates that I referred to before. So that's really not an option. But it still poses a dilemma. What are you going to do? Basically, what the military commanders do is they make two very general assumptions. This has got nothing to do with legal principles, but from a military perspective, I think the two assumptions that the commanders typically make are more than reasonable. The first assumption is the stone throwers were Palestinian males, aged between about 10 and 30 years old. And that's generally going to be the case. The next assumption is they came from the nearest Palestinian village. And that's almost certainly going to be the case. What the commander then does with those two assumptions is he will hand those over to the local Israeli intelligence officer. So just as the West Bank for the last 50 years has been divided up into military jurisdictions, it's also been divided up into intelligence jurisdictions, which means each area has assigned to it a dedicated Israeli intelligence officer and has had a dedicated Israeli intelligence officer for the last 50 years. Now, what that tells you is an awful lot of intelligence must have been built up on these communities. Mm-hmm. And what we found is it's an excellent way of controlling people. Is, you know, the easiest and most cost-effective way of controlling people is to really map these communities from an intelligence perspective. And again, this is not unique to this situation. You would find it in any military operation which is going to involve controlling a civilian population for any length of time. So the kinds of things the intelligence officer will know about a village are obvious things, like how many people live there, political affiliations, who might be Hamas, who might be Fatah, who's not attached to any political party. Perhaps even more importantly, who has been locked up before. According to UN statistics, since June 1967, something like 800,000 men, women and children have been detained in the West Bank by the military. What that means is that at the friction points, at these Palestinian villages located close to settlements or close to roads used by settlers, there have been many, many arrests each year over the past 50 years. So one thing the intelligence officer can do, which again is not unique to the situation here, is you look at who have you arrested before for a similar kind of crime, and you round those people up and see what they have to say for themselves. The most important thing the intelligence officer will do, however, is he or she will look to see who are the Palestinian informants in the village. Now, for obvious reasons, it's quite difficult to get accurate data on the level of collaborators. But what we know from all the evidence that we've collected over the years is a lot of pressure is put on people in the interrogation room to either provide information on other people in the village or actively to recruit them as collaborators. We were in a town in the north of the West Bank a couple of months ago, a town called Azun. And some of the people we were talking to there, this town has a population of 13,000. The individuals we were talking to, their estimate was that 2 out of 3 people in the town were collaborators. And there's any number of ways that you can force people into collaboration. So you can use threats and intimidation. You can threaten to arrest family members. if you know that the family have work permits to work inside Israel, for Palestinians to be given a work permit to work inside Israel is a valuable commodity. There's a lot of unemployment in the West Bank. You can earn more money in Israel. So if the family have work permits, the threat can be, we're going to take away all your work permits if you don't cooperate with us. Alternatively, you can offer things. You can offer work permits for a cooperation, small amounts of cash, that sort of thing. So whatever the figures are, and it's impossible to know exactly what they are, from what I've observed in the last 10 years, I think it's fair to say the level of infiltration in the society is extreme. Now, if you're in the business of trying to control a population, that's, I think, one of the best and most effective ways you can do it is by infiltrating that society with informants. And it works basically on two levels. The first level is you get a lot of intelligence. The drawback to that is the intelligence will be mixed. Some of it will be accurate. Some of it will not be accurate. The advantage of this system, if you're talking about low-level offenses like throwing stones or protesting, it doesn't really matter whether the intelligence is accurate or not. The point is you need to compile a list of names of people in the village who will be arrested for that act of resistance, collective punishment. If you're talking about something much more serious like bomb making, weapons offenses, then that doesn't apply. You need to identify the bomb maker. But if you're talking about stone throwers, protesters, then it's about collective punishment. By that, I don't mean to suggest that the authorities do not want to identify stone throwers. If all things being equal, they would much rather identify the stone throwers than not. But the option is, if you can't identify a stone thrower, someone will still get arrested. The village has to understand that any form of resistance will not be tolerated. The second aspect of flooding the society with informants is even more powerful, and that is the community knows that it is infiltrated. And that has a profound psychological impact on that community. No one knows who to trust. Which one of my neighbors is the informant? What that means is it's very difficult to organize, whether you're organizing peaceful protests, violent protests, political activity, or armed struggle. Whatever it is that you want to organize, it's very difficult if there's so many informants. And that alone, I think, goes a long way to explain why when you look at the actual data, there's very little coherent resistance in the West Bank, be it political, peaceful, military. It's very difficult to organize. And so from the Israeli military's perspective, that's very powerful. It means you can do it cheaply. And these things are only sustainable if they're affordable. And this is affordable. So what will happen is the intelligence officer will make contact with any informants in the village, get a list of names, hand that over to the local commander, and then his job is to make those arrests.
How old is the local commander typically? Any idea?
It can vary. Okay. It can vary, and there's obviously a chain of command, like in any army. But certainly, the soldiers out in the field conducting the arrests, mm-hmm. they will be young conscripts. Many of them will be 19, 20 years old, and the officer might be 24, 25 years old. The commander's job is to make the arrests of the people on that list that he got from the intelligence officer. Those arrests generally will take place within 48 hours. That's important so that the village comprehends cause and effect. You resist us, there will be an immediate, overwhelming military response until you understand resistance is futile. More than half of the cases we document, those arrests occur at night. Usually around 2 o'clock in the morning.
Did you say more than half?
Over half. I think it's something like 52% along those lines at the moment, or on the data we've collected. Mm-hmm. There are a number of practical reasons why you might want to arrest people at night. The first reason I think is very practical, and that is if you show up at 2 o'clock in the morning, there's a good chance the person's going to be home. Second reason is if you send a military unit into a refugee camp or a village in the middle of the day, chances are young men will come out and throw stones at you. Now, there's an Israeli organization called Breaking the Silence. I think you may be talking to them. Yep. Made up of former Israeli soldiers. They talk about how one of the strategies of the Israeli military in the West Bank is to make their presence felt. What that means is in the communities, Palestinian communities at the friction points, near settlements, near strategic roads, you send the military in day and night, even when nothing has happened, no one has resisted, to wind everyone up, to stir things up, to put people on the back foot, to psychologically put them at a disadvantage. So they are always thinking, what will the military do next? The advantage of that is if all the people can think about is, what will the military do next? They're not being proactive. They're just reacting, which means they don't have the headspace to come up with a counter strategy, which is what you want if you're in the business of occupation. However, if you do that and send a military convoy in during the day, you will get clashes. Sometimes you don't want clashes. If you don't want clashes, you go in 2 o'clock in the morning. The third reason is probably the most important reason, and that is if you send heavily armed military units into a civilian population in the middle of the night, you will scare the hell out of the village. Now, if you're the soldier who's been given the job by the politicians to make sure that settlers aren't injured or killed in the West Bank, living in occupied territory, you have to find strategies. You know, to put it at its absolute crudest, you have to find strategies to intimidate and suppress any idea of resistance amongst the local population. And night raids are an excellent way of doing that. So let's assume it's a night raid. The military comes in large numbers, surrounds the relevant houses. Generally, they'll arrest 5 or 10 people. They won't come in just to arrest one person, typically. Generally begins with loud, aggressive banging at the front door. If the door is not opened up immediately, it will usually be broken in or blown off its hinges. Another technique is the military will come in and they'll come into the village quietly. They have a device which I think works off pressure. They attach that to the front door frame, pressurizes the door frame, and you can open the door, a locked door, whilst the family still sleeps. What happens then is the soldiers can enter the house, enter all the bedrooms. The family will wake up and see soldiers, armed soldiers in their bedroom. Again, if you've been given the job by the politicians to intimidate that community, that's a good way of doing it. Family will be gathered into one room. The commander will check the ID cards of the family against the list of names he was given by the intelligence officer, and they'll make the relevant arrests. Most cases, no information is provided. Sometimes a bit of paper is given to the father saying which interrogation center the child will be taken to. Nothing is said about, at this point in time, about your legal rights. So under Israeli military law, you have the right to consult with a lawyer prior to interrogation, the right to silence. You're not informed of those rights upon arrest. In most cases, you're not informed of those rights at all.
And there are not requirements of informing them?
Yes, there are requirements under Israeli military law,
okay.
But they're mostly disrespected.
Okay.
It's a very chaotic scene. So everyone will be gathered in a living room. Many of these households are quite large. It would not be surprising to have 6 to 10 people living in a house, you know, perhaps 3 generations. About 10 soldiers will enter the building. Like I mentioned, most of them are conscripts. They might be 19, 20 years old. They're nervous. They've just been given a briefing by their commanders telling them this is a dangerous situation. This is a dangerous village. So they're stressed. The parents are obviously highly stressed, and the young children would generally be screaming, terrified at seeing soldiers in the house. The parents are usually yelling at the commander, who's probably 24 years old or so, trying to get information about, you know, why are you arresting my son, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a highly volatile situation. Given those circumstances, what the commander will typically do is he will tell the family, listen, we're going to take your son away for a couple of hours for questioning, and then we'll bring him back. That never happens. But the reason the commanders often say that is just to try to settle everyone down, because his job now is to get his soldiers out of there quickly and safely as possible with the detainees. And that tends to be what happens.
And how good is the commander's Arabic? I assume he has to speak to the families in Arabic because Hebrew isn't going to...
It really, really varies. Now, there'll be... sometimes there'll be fluent Arabic speakers. It may not be the officer. It might be a Druze soldier who's brought along. As sometimes there's the Arabic is not great in the unit. You know, they usually know the Arabic words for shut up or, you know, those sort of things. It really depends. Okay. More often than not, in my experience, is there will be an Arabic speaker who speaks sufficient Arabic to get the job done.
Okay.
Some of the Palestinian, anyone in the household has a work permit to work inside Israel, they probably speak some Hebrew too. The soldiers then leave with the detainees. They get into the armored vehicles and they drive off. One thing we've noticed from the evidence we collect is most children report being placed on the metal floor of the military vehicle, tied and blindfolded. Mm-hmm. The reason that happens in most cases, not every case, but in most cases, it's pure logistics. It's a troop carrier. If there are enough seats for the soldiers and the detainees, everyone gets a seat. If there's not, it's not going to be a soldier who's sitting on the floor. The problem with that is the road system in the West Bank is quite rough. So imagine you're zip tied with one tie, with your hands behind your back quite tightly. You're blindfolded and you're placed face down on the metal floor of a military vehicle. That is going to cause you more stress and injury. Mm-hmm. On top of that, you sometimes get soldiers pushing the detainees around a bit, putting their boots on them, sometimes worse. What happens in the back of the vehicle really depends on the mood and disposition of the 24-year-old commander. Some of them will discipline the soldiers if they start to abuse the detainees. Some will not. And I think that aspect of the system too shows this system is obviously very damaging if you're on the receiving end of it. What is less obvious but equally damaging, I think, is if you're in the position of the soldiers. And I think what is quite telling is if you look at some of the video testimonies from the former soldiers on Breaking the Silence's website, you will see, and on our website too, you'll see that many of them say that they entered the army to do their 3 years national service with a degree of enthusiasm. You know, they've been brought up to believe they're defending Israel's borders, they're defending Israel from terrorism, and as you know, they frequently point out, it's a tough neighborhood. Is sometimes certainly the case, but frequently these soldiers then find themselves in the West Bank in some village, in a house, and it might be a 15-year-old or a 14-year-old boy they're arresting, and it might be for protesting. And some of these soldiers then begin to have some doubts about, well, this is not exactly what I thought I was signing up to do. On top of that, then they see, not in every case, but in some cases, they'll see some mistreatment occurring. Some of the other soldiers roughing up the detainees, maybe the commander roughing up a detainee. And the problem, the dilemma for that 19-year-old conscript is, what do? You know it's wrong, but if you start speaking up or complaining, remembering you're the new person in the unit, if you start lodging complaints in your first week of a 3-year national service, that's going to be a pretty tough 3 years. Now, the really tragic, I think, aspect of all of this is what the soldiers then go on to say, the ones that give these testimonies, is they say, you know, in the first year, they're very conflicted for the reasons I just gave. But they find, not in every case, but in many cases, by the time they get to their third year, they're the ones slapping around the detainees. It just erodes away your humanity. And that's what I think is so corrosive with this. And let's be clear, this is not unique to the Israeli military. You give any military in the world, no matter how well trained they are, the job of policing civilians, you will probably find this kind of stuff happening after about 6 months. And after 50 years, you know, it's endemic.
Yeah, I mean, we saw that with the U.S. in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that was nothing close to 50 years. Mm. That was only after being there a few years. Abu Ghraib and the likes.
Yeah, I think any army, it doesn't, like I say, I don't think you can really provide training to stop this. You can do your best, but soldiers are not trained to police civilians. Yeah. So what happens then is eventually that child will be taken to an interrogation center generally in the West Bank. These are located in the larger settlements, generally the settlement blocks, Gush Etzion, Ariel, Binyamin, those sort of places. The problem for the commander is, not in every case, but in many cases, if he shows up at 3 o'clock in the morning at an interrogation center, he may not be allowed in. many of these interrogators have better things to do with their time at 3 o'clock in the morning than to interrogate a Palestinian child, like sleeping. And so in many cases, that would mean the unit will just have to sit in the military vehicles all night or the rest of the night, which is not much fun. So rather than do that frequently, they will go to one of the smaller settlements or military bases dotted throughout the West Bank, which will have facilities for the soldiers. So the soldiers can get out, get something to eat, have some coffee, smoke cigarettes, whatever. Meanwhile, the detainees are, in most cases, left tied and blindfolded and put in shipping containers, or sometimes just left outside. And that's where you remain until 8 o'clock in the morning. Again, it's completely arbitrary. You do get cases. We get some children reporting that the commander told the soldiers to untie, unblindfold, get something for the child to eat or drink. But that's the minority of cases. The majority of cases, you'll be, whether you're an adult or a child, you'll be sat, tied, and blindfolded in a shipping container or outside. To add to that, it's not uncommon for passing soldiers to give you a bit of a poke, maybe a kick, push, shove, that sort of thing. Sometimes as a bit of a joke, you bring a military dog close to the individual, they're blindfolded, but they can tell it's a dog close to them. And that, you know, for a 19-year-old, that can be past the time as a bit of amusement. Obviously, if you're the blindfolded individual sitting on the ground, you probably don't see it that way. Again, it's not unique to here. This is human nature. If there's been heightened violence in the region, if, say, a settler was killed yesterday, or if a soldier was stabbed yesterday, then it's not uncommon to find a bit of payback tonight in the back of the Jeep or in the shipping container. Again, that's not unique to this conflict. It's human nature. 8 o'clock in the morning, you're put back in the military vehicle and you're taken to one of those larger settlements for interrogation. By the time you find yourself sitting in the interrogation room, it's probably about 10 hours in many cases. You probably haven't had anything to eat or drink. You've been sleep deprived in most cases. You've been tied and blindfolded that entire time. You know, in most cases, your parents don't know where you are and you don't know what your legal rights are. Fairly intimidating circumstances you find yourself in, whether you're an adult or a child. Psychologically, most people are in a fairly weakened position. Now, if you happen to be an interrogator, that's exactly what you want. It's much easier if the person you're interrogating is psychologically in a weakened position, assuming that what you're after is a confession. So at this point, the child should be allowed to consult with a lawyer. There are some exceptions, but in most cases, you should be allowed to consult with a lawyer and informed of your right to silence. That, in most cases, that's not happening. In the cases where it's happening, particularly like the right to silence, it's clearly inadequate. What is sometimes the child is given a bit of paper which just says, you've got the right to remain silent. Afterwards, when we ask those children, what did you understand by that? Most of them don't really understand what that actually means. It takes, in any decent juvenile justice system, it takes quite a lot to explain properly to a child what their legal rights are. And that's why you often have a parent present at that time, because it's a highly stressful situation, even in the best juvenile justice system in the world. In this situation, most cases, the child will be alone with the interrogator. And so many of these children, a case we had last week, the child was informed of his right to silence. When asked, what did you think that meant? He thought that meant you couldn't interrupt the interrogator. That's what he understood to be his right to silence. So they're big problems, obviously, in that system. And that's in the cases where they're informed. In most cases, they're not informed.
Sure.
What the interrogator will generally do is he'll start by making a broad allegation against the individual, like, why do you throw stones at Israelis? At 2 p.m. on Wednesday, you were seen in this location throwing stones. What do you have to say about it? It's frequently just generally, why do you throw stones at Israelis? So sometimes children, after being asked this question and put under a lot of pressure for several hours, they might confess to throwing stones a year ago at a protest, which is clearly not why they were arrested. Most children, almost all the children, will initially deny they've done anything wrong. And I can't comment on how many children are throwing stones or not throwing stones. I know lots of people throw stones in the West Bank, but you're not going to determine who to any degree of precision with a system like this. Whether the child has been throwing stones or not, he's going to deny it. And then the interrogator goes to work. Basically, the child will remain tied. The blindfold will be removed. He will approach the child typically and start yelling at him, threatening him, intimidating him, threatening to arrest his mother, his sister, revoke work permits, that sort of thing. One thing all interrogators will do, and again, it's not unique to this system, is they'll say to the child, listen, all of your friends who we arrested with you, they've all confessed. They all said they were throwing stones and you were with them. And because they've confessed, we've sent them all home. So then the child hears this. He thinks, well, first of all my friends have ratted on me and they're all sitting at home. So I'm going to rat on them and I'm going to go home. It may be you're actually the first person to provide the confession. Then what the interrogator does is he'll go to each interrogation room with the same strategy until everyone has provided a confession against everyone else. And then that's the primary evidence used. You might try and rustle up a soldier if it has to go to court to say, yeah, I saw this child throw stones. But the primary evidence is the confessions of other children. Within 2 to 4 days, you'll be taken to a military court, one of two in the West Bank. That's usually where you're going to see your lawyer for the first time. And it's kind of limited what the lawyer can do for you at that stage. What generally happens is if the child says to the lawyer, I'm innocent, I signed this confession because, you know, they were nasty to me, et cetera, et cetera. The lawyer will say, okay, but I know you say you're innocent, but if you plead guilty, I can cut a deal with the prosecution. You might spend 4 to 5 months in prison, throwing stones, no one injured, no property damage. If, on the other hand, you want us to challenge the system, you know, you say you were mistreated, that's why you signed the confession, you, in most cases, you're going to be denied bail, which means you're going to have to sit in prison on remand, waiting for your case to come on for hearing before the judge. That can take 6 months. So often, particularly in the cases of children, it's quicker simply to plead guilty. There's another dynamic too. If for some reason you decided, I want to challenge the system, your case after 6 months is brought before a military judge. There are a number of factors there. Now, one factor is some of these military judges live in the settlements. So if you're accused of throwing stones at a settler car and the judge is a settler, that's only going to go one way. Another aspect is that if it does go to a full evidentiary hearing, the evidence for the prosecution will be the interrogator saying that he didn't mistreat you, that you freely confessed, you were informed of all your legal rights, etc., and quite possibly a soldier or two who will say, yeah, I saw him throwing stones. For the military judge, it's much more likely that he's going to accept the evidence of those soldiers, basically comrades in arms, than some Palestinian child who says all these terrible things happened. Then if you're convicted, you'll get a stiffer sentence than had you pleaded guilty. And that explains why overwhelming majority of cases end in a plea bargain. And the latest data indicates the court has a conviction rate of 95%.
And all cases are heard by a judge.
All cases come before a military judge, but most cases there will not be a full evidentiary hearing because they'll be resolved by way of plea bargain.
Yeah.
And that happens in pretty much most jurisdictions, but not to the extent.
Yeah.
And also in places like the US, for example, if the police don't inform you of your Miranda rights, if they don't inform you that you have the right to silence, etc., then your case is dismissed. Whilst that is the evidentiary rule in the Israeli military courts, it's not an exclusionary principle. It's just discretionary. So even if the lawyer says to the judge, my client wasn't informed of his rights, by the law in the military courts and in Israel, that doesn't automatically mean the case is dismissed. So there's no incentive in many ways to comply with these provisions.
Yeah. But there's no juries in military courts.
No, okay. It's the military judge.
Right.
Yeah. So what happens then is according to the Israeli prison service, the overwhelming majority of prisoners are transferred to prisons inside Israel. Now, that is a war crime under the Fourth Geneva Convention. In 1967, Israel was entitled to place the West Bank under martial law. Under that law, you can establish military courts to prosecute civilians in certain circumstances, which they did. But also the courts and the prisons have to be in occupied territory. They can't be outside. And that is classified as a war crime to do that. The reason for that is the experiences of the Second World War in Nazi Germany, where the Germans transferred people all around Europe in and out of occupied territory. POWs, obviously, Jewish people obviously were transferred to the death camps, and other civilian populations were transferred everywhere. And so these are quite rigid rules that if there is a conflict and there is an occupation, you cannot move your citizens into occupied territory, and you can't move the civilian population out of occupied territory. Everyone has to stay put. Those are very important legal principles, which came about through, you know, great sacrifice, both American sacrifice, European sacrifice, you know, that we're all familiar with. But after several generations, we seem to have forgotten some of that sacrifice, and we pay lip service to some of these principles at our peril, I think.
And technically speaking, Israel is following the Geneva Conventions by setting up military courts.
Exactly. And what's interesting with that is if you look at the Israeli military order that established the military courts on the 7th of June, 1967, it specifically refers to the 4th Geneva Convention as the jurisdictional basis upon which that's done. This morning, I spent this morning in the military court. We took a delegation from the UK there. When we went in, we were given by a soldier, I think it's a 9-page document prepared by the Israeli military, justifying, explaining why the military courts are legal. The first sentence of that document says, these courts were established in accordance with international law. And then the third paragraph says, under Article 66 of the 4th Geneva Convention. So not only on the 7th of June 1967 was the Israeli military relying on the 4th Geneva Convention to justify prosecuting Palestinian civilians in military courts. To this day, they are relying on the 4th Geneva Convention. And yet, should anyone in America or anywhere else raise the legality of the settlements in occupied territory, which are prohibited under Article 49 of the 4th Geneva Convention, Israel says the convention doesn't apply. Now, as a lawyer, I cannot think of a better way of delegitimizing a legal system than cherry-picking which legal obligations you're going to abide by and which legal obligations you're simply going to ignore because they're inconvenient to you. Why that should bother people in America and Europe and other places is because these principles were enshrined in law, which Israel signed, America signed, Europe signed. We signed these because of the sacrifice and the great cost and pain we experienced in two world wars. And it may be that we don't pay much attention to these at the moment, but you can be sure that if we find ourselves in another major conflict, like we're almost certainly going to find ourselves this century, whether it's, who knows, whether it's with Russia or with China or whoever, there may be no legal framework whatsoever providing any form of protection to POWs or anyone. And I think that's a real indictment on our on the post-war generations. If, you know, we're all very good at once a year to show up and say, you know, lest we forget the sacrifice. But if you really want to honor those war dead, the way you do it is to make sure that our elected representatives abide by the laws they've signed up to. They're designed for our own protection, all of our protections. Now, I'm not naive to think that any system of law can guarantee there won't be any more wars and there won't be any, you know, that it's the answer to all our problems. But no one has come up with a better idea of how do we resolve our disputes and how do we regulate warfare if it does break out.
And just to repeat, Israel has signed the Geneva Convention.
In 1951, okay. Israel signed it, and it's relying on the 4th Geneva Convention to justify prosecuting hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in military courts. So when the US and Europe says to Putin, don't annex Crimea, we're going to impose sanctions on you for annexing Crimea, if I was Putin, I would say, tell it to the Israelis. They've annexed East Jerusalem. You know, why are you picking on me? And that's the danger, that even though Israel may be a great friend of the US, you cannot simply decide, okay, we're going to apply the rules to people we don't like, but we'll turn a blind eye to our friends. You will destroy that system. This has the potential to destroy the international legal order established after the Second World War.
Yeah. And so the U.S. set up military courts in Iraq, right? Legally. In the same way that Israel set up military courts in the occupied territories in the West Bank. The difference between those two is important, I think, and that is they are meant to be, and in the case of the U.S. and Iraq, temporary.
Exactly.
Right? What does that word entail legally? Do we know? Is there a definition of what temporary means?
There's no definition, and I think no one would want to agree to a definition simply because each conflict is different. So there is no exact definition, but I think anything beyond 10 years, you know, you don't want an occupation to be going on for more than 10 years, because the whole idea of all of this is it's acknowledged military occupations and martial law are inherently unsatisfactory. You suspend many of the rights people have. And so it should be temporary. Having said that, it's a crisis moment. You're going to, things are not going to be normal, and you need some form of regulation, but it has to be temporary. The real issue here, though, is after 50 years, I mean, no one, no matter what side of the coin you're arguing, you can't, no one can reasonably say 50 years is temporary.
And I think it was, I don't know, 2 weeks ago, maybe, Netanyahu was at a celebration of 50 years from 67, from taking the occupied territories, and he flat out said at that celebration, we will never leave. We will never uproot. So that's from the mouth of the prime minister himself.
Which you really cannot imagine a more clearer statement of a prime minister or a leader of a country saying, I do not believe in the rule of law. I might want to apply it when it helps me, but if it doesn't help what I want to do, I'm just going to ignore it and do your worst. You know, from an American perspective, American taxpayers are quite happy to continue to pay $4 billion a year for weapons to Israel. So if you're Netanyahu, you can say these things and there are no consequences. So why would you? But another issue, too, with an issue of military occupation is, I think if you were arguing this situation in a courtroom, you would not present it any longer as a temporary military occupation. I think if you look at the objective facts, it's quite clearly a de facto annexation of the West Bank. And the evidence for that is duration. 50 years is not temporary, I think, in anyone's book. The second one are the settlements. Once you start building settlements in occupied territory, like I said, it's a war crime. It's also an exercise of sovereignty. You're putting your own civilians into that territory. They're building towns and villages, shopping malls, hospitals, and you're applying your civilian law to them. The third thing is taking the resources. So under the law of occupation, if the occupying power touches any of the resources in occupied territory, it can only do so for the benefit of the occupied people. So there was I heard Trump say that he couldn't quite understand why, when America was in Iraq, why you didn't take all the oil to pay for the, well, you can't because it's illegal. The only way you can touch the oil is for the benefit of the Iraqi people. But in the West Bank, a lot of the water resources have been taken by Israel. And that looks like annexation of territory, an illegal annexation, which is prohibited under Article 2 of the UN Charter. And again, if it's okay for the Israelis, why shouldn't Putin do it? And why shouldn't the Chinese do it in the South China Sea, you know, building islands in some of the busiest shipping lanes in the world? The problem with this is we are destined then to have another major conflict. If we can't apply these basic, simple legal principles that were drafted at the end of the Second World War to try and avoid these situations based on the experiences we just went through. You know, and America played a really driving, important role in making sure those principles were enshrined and everyone signed them. Then, you know, probably not us, but our children and our grandchildren will go through another major conflict, and they'll be the ones paying the price.
You said something in passing that I want you to expand upon because it's important. You said that the settlers who live in the West Bank, so in the same territory as the children you're describing who go through the military courts, they are not subject to the military courts. Can you just expand upon
that? What's interesting with that is technically they are. So the Israeli military law in the West Bank applies to everyone in the West Bank, Israeli, Palestinian, etc. These courts are, anyone who's been there will see these are not what you would consider a proper court of law. You know, the way they process such mass numbers of people, disrespect for even their own legal principles, legal rights, etc. No one, no Israeli in their right mind would want to find themselves in the military court. The dilemma for the military, though, is how do you draft a law that is not openly discriminatory? You can't draft a law that says, you know, this only applies to this ethnic group and not that ethnic group. You know, that's rather, you know, you don't need to be too bright to be slightly more subtle than that. Mm-hmm. So the way the Israeli military authorities have got around that problem is military law still applies to the settlers in the West Bank, but they've also passed some regulations which say an Israeli, and they in great detail define exactly what an Israeli is, who finds him or herself in the West Bank, is subject to concurrent jurisdiction, which means they're subject to both military law and Israeli civilian law. And then the discretion is given to the prosecutor to determine which court system you'll be prosecuted in. So perhaps not surprisingly, if a settler is ever arrested for anything in the West Bank, they're prosecuted in a civilian court at the discretion of the prosecutor, which has far more protections and rights than a military court. So you could have two children in the West Bank. One child is a Jewish settler living in the West Bank. The other is a Palestinian child living in a village next door. Those children come out of their homes and they start throwing stones at each other. The Palestinian child will go to a military court with far fewer rights and protections. The Israeli child, assuming he's arrested, will be sent to a juvenile civilian court in Israel with many more protections and rights than that Palestinian child for the same offense in the same territory.
And probably not with a conviction rate of 95%.
That's correct. Yeah. And that highlights, you know, it's a clear case of discrimination based on ethnicity.
Mm-hmm. Can you say a little bit about, so we're almost finished with the story of, you know, a typical child who gets detained and what that looks like. A little bit about how certain, what are the punishments for certain offenses? We've talked mostly about the most common one, which is rock throwing. What are the mandated sentences for rock throwing? Or say, I know another one is like organizing a political event. Can you say a little bit about those?
Yeah, so like with most systems around the world, they're maximum penalties for offenses, but frequently people don't get the maximum. So the maximum penalty for throwing stones at a moving vehicle is 20 years in prison. Throwing stones where a vehicle is not involved is 10 years imprisonment. Children don't get 10 or 20 years in prison. If you were to throw a stone at a vehicle and kill someone, you would get closer to 20 years in prison. But most of the cases are not those cases. Protesting, it's an offense for more than 10 Palestinians to gather for political purposes. Unless you have first got a permit from the Israeli military commander. No Israeli military commander is ever going to give a Palestinian permit to protest against the occupation, and no Palestinian is going to apply for one. So pretty much every political gathering in the West Bank is illegal. That carries a maximum penalty of 10 years imprisonment. Again, people don't get 10 years imprisonment. You'll get probably a few months, or maybe up to a year if you're an organizer. But when people talk about, you know, the only democracy in the Middle East, well, that's 2.9 million Palestinians in the West Bank have lived under martial law, which they have no say in what that law, the composition of that law, for the last 50 years. And they're prosecuted in military courts and they're not allowed to protest. Doesn't sound like democracy. You know, it's like Animal Farm. You know, we're all equal, but some of us get a bit better democracy than others. I mean, now, the official Israeli response to such an argument would be, oh, but this is a temporary military occupation. Well, then the question is, what are your settlements doing there? Mm-hmm. You know, it's really having your cake and eating it. Mm-hmm. And the danger for the rest of us is it completely delegitimizes and undermines the rule of law, mm-hmm. which a lot of Americans and others sacrificed an awful lot to put in place. And that's why people, I think, everywhere should be angry about this.
I've also heard, and maybe you know something of this, maybe not, that they're monitoring more and more social media.
Very much so.
And that you can get detained, maybe, or at least questioned, if you say something inflammatory on social media or if you're trying to organize something via social media.
Yeah, so there's offenses of incitement. And you have to look at each individual case. You know, there may be cases of very grave incitement to violence. And you have those sort of offenses in many countries. You know, you can't go out and call on everyone to murder a particular group in society. You know, every society has those sort of laws. But this law, you know, it picks up an awful lot of people. It, you know, a lot of it is also to pick up any form of organizing or any form of legitimate protest as well. And that's the problem is there, under the law, you have no right of legitimate protest. Now, military law and the Geneva Convention, Fourth Geneva Convention, permits that for a short period of time because it is so unsatisfactory. But this, you know, is going on indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
I should add one thing, just to finish the story too. This is a generalization and there are exceptions, but the evidence we've collected and the conversations we've had indicates it's a highly effective system. So these children are released and most come out traumatized. They never want to go near a road used by settlers. They never want to see another Israeli soldier. In addition to spending whatever it might be, 5 or 6 months in prison, they will also, their parents will be fined anywhere from about $1,000 to $10,000 shekels, which is about approximately $250 up to probably $2,500, something like that, which is a lot of money for a lot of these villagers. So that's a good way of controlling villages that protest or throw stones, etc. You send the military in constantly, you round people up and you bankrupt the village until they give up. The third penalty you will receive in every case is a suspended sentence. So in addition to 5 months in prison, you'll frequently get another 5 months in prison or so, suspended for 5 years. What that means is if you're picked up for any other offense in the next 5 years, you will have to serve that additional 5 months before you're punished for the new offense. Now, the way that works is this, that if you happen to live in a refugee camp or a village near a settlement, which has a constant military presence, which I spoke about. Let's say you're one of these children, you've been to prison, you have a suspended sentence hanging over your head for 5 years. Your mother tells you, go down to the shop and buy some milk. You're on your way down to the local shop to buy some milk. Suddenly, four military jeeps drive into your village near the shop. Other kids start throwing stones at those jeeps. There's general mayhem and chaos. Now, if you're a soldier, you just see a bunch of kids chucking rocks at you. So you're going to get out of your jeep and you're going to start firing tear gas at them and see if you can catch a few. You're going to run and catch the nearest child to you. Now, that child might be a stone thrower or that child might be the boy who's going to get some milk. It's going to be your word, the soldier's word against that child's word. He's going to go straight back to prison for five months if it's a contest between his word and that of the soldier. The moral of that story is be very careful before you ever leave home. The upshot of all of this, and it comes back to where we started this, is it's not coincidental that children are detained, live within 1.02 kilometers of the settlement. If the politicians think it's a good idea to put, including Jerusalem, 600,000 civilians into occupied territory in violation of international law, and then you give the poor soldiers the job of, well, you've got to figure out how we make this work, they have three choices. They can basically kill everyone in occupied territory, which they're not doing. They can deport everyone in occupied territory, which they're not doing. Third option is you've got to intimidate people. And you can be more sophisticated. You don't have to intimidate all 2.9 million Palestinians in the West Bank, but you have to get very good at intimidating the ones who live next door to settlements. And that's how you make it work. That's how you get that statistic, according to the U.S. State Department, of no settlers killed in 2012. The bottom line is there's a very good reason that settlement construction in occupied territory is a war crime because it leads to this kind of stuff, inevitably. There is no nice way of doing settlement construction in occupied territory. They are at the epicenter of multiple human rights abuses, which is why they're illegal.
Yeah, it's distressing, obviously, but it's so compelling. It's so helpful Because I think often in the United States, people feel like, where's the Palestinian Gandhi or things like that. And when I heard this, it helped me understand what they're really up against. For example, there's a gentleman, and I want to end here shortly, Isa Amru. Do you know him?
Mm-hmm.
In Hebron, who does work hard to try and do peaceful demonstrations. And he's been detained, and he is facing charges and is likely going to spend time in prison simply for organizing peaceful protests against the occupation in Hebron. So how do you mount, right, a resistance, as you've articulated how difficult it is or what they're up against in trying to do so?
So what I like, as a lawyer, what I like about the rule of law is, it's all very well saying, where's the Gandhi? But what I like about institutions and the rule of law is, if they work well, you don't have to rely on Gandhi. How many of us are Gandhi?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think as a society, you've got really serious problems if the only thing that can save you is Gandhi. You know, how many times in a century does a country get a Gandhi?
Yeah.
You shouldn't have to rely on a Gandhi. That's what the rule of law is about. That's what people sacrificed, you know, their lives for in many cases, is to have some basic rules that we can all agree on and we try to live by them.
Yeah.
And if someone's got a better idea, I'm sure we'd all like to hear it, yeah, hear about it.
That's excellent. That's a great place to end. And so thank you so much, Gerard, for coming and articulating how Israel does occupation.
Pleasure.